Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to Spotlight on Youth, a radio show dedicated to social and legal trends impacting the rights and well-being of children across the country. Spotlight on Youth is a project of the Children's Law Center, Inc., a not-for-profit children's rights legal services organization. My name is Lauren Litton. I am the host of the show. The show is being streamed live over the Internet and will be available on demand after its conclusion. We encourage you to participate by asking our guests questions live on air by dialing 347-994-1149. That's 347-994-1149, and then press the number 1 on your telephone keypad to indicate you have a question and you will be placed in a queue. Also, feel free to log into the chat room and pose a question there. In today's show, we're going to explore the notion of the school-to-prison pipeline, which the ACLU has called one of the most important civil rights challenges facing our nation today. Joining us for this discussion are Sarah Beal and the Honorable Kim Brown. Let me take a moment to properly introduce them. Judge Kim Brown was appointed and then elected to the bench of the Franklin County Court of Common Pleas, Domestic Relations and Juvenile Division in 2002. She was re-elected for full terms in 2004 and 2010. Judge Brown was twice re-elected as the court's lead juvenile judge and has served as a co-chair of the Franklin County Juvenile Justice Community Planning Initiative, or DMC Committee, and has served on the Executive Committee of the Ohio Association of Domestic Relations Judges and on the Ohio Supreme Court's Rules Advisory Committee. Judge Brown has created innovative programs to educate and inspire youth and is passionate about organizations dedicated to the development and advocacy of children and women. Additionally, she has worked as an adjunct professor at the Ohio Dominican University, as an associate attorney with the law firm McGuire & Schneider, and was the director of legal operations for the Ohio Bureau of Workers' Compensation. Judge Brown holds a bachelor's degree from the University of Cincinnati and a Juris Doctorate from the Ohio State University Moritz College of Law. Sarah Beal received both her undergraduate and law degrees from the Ohio State University and clerked for Chief Judge James Carr of the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Ohio before being awarded a Skadden Fellowship with the Legal Assistance Foundation of Metropolitan Chicago. While in Chicago, Sarah designed and operated a legal clinic inside a public charter high school on the west side of the city and developed a strong commitment to community-based lawyering as a means of working for systems change. Sarah moved back to Ohio in early 2008 to focus on systemic advocacy on education law issues as a staff attorney at the Ohio Poverty Law Center. Sarah is deeply committed to empowering low-income children and their families. She has published articles on school discipline and safe haven laws and chairs the Ohio Statewide Task Force on Education Law Issues. Sarah is also a core group member of the Dignity in Schools campaign, a national coalition of advocates who aim to challenge the push-out in nation schools. Welcome to both of you to Spotlight on Youth.
Thank you. Thank you.
Sarah, maybe we can start off. When we use the catchphrase school-to-prison pipeline, what do we mean?
Well, that's the catchy advocate description for the phenomenon that has resulted from an overemphasis in schools on policies and practices that lead to the incarceration of youth, whether that's through the juvenile or the criminal justice system. And it operates directly through the criminalization of youth for school-based incidences. So in that situation, we're thinking of police officers in schools, children being arrested in school for behavior that occurs in the school. And often that behavior is the kind of behavior that I think even 10 years ago children would not have been arrested in school for. Pretty minor nonviolent misbehavior is leading to arrests in a lot of schools today. The school-to-prison pipeline also operates indirectly through policies and practices that lead students to drop out, or which makes them much more likely to become incarcerated at some point later in their lives. And examples of those kinds of policies are copious use of out-of-school suspensions, expulsions of children from school for periods of 1 and even up to 2 years, disciplinary referrals to alternative schools, and high-stakes testing, primarily motivated by the No Child Left Behind Act.
I've heard it said before that the school zero tolerance policies are often the first step in a child's journey through the pipeline. How have these policies contributed to the crisis?
Well, zero tolerance policies force schools to take a blanket approach to all behavior, and basically require schools to apply a specific consequence regardless of the individual circumstances. And we see that a lot with weapons and drugs, where kids who bring those kinds of things to school are expelled for often very long periods of time from school, which almost guarantees that they're going to eventually drop out or not finish high school at some point, whether it's right away or down the trail a ways. Actually, I've done some research recently that shows that prior suspension is more likely to cause a child to drop out of high school more than any other factor, including the child's socioeconomic status, not living with both biological parents, high number of school changes, and having sex before age 15. Being suspended is more likely to cause a child to drop out than any of those things, which I found really surprising.
Mm-hmm.
So this sort of blanket approach to discipline is really harming kids.
What are some of the risk factors for youth who are subject to this pipeline?
Well, the biggest risk factor is being African-American. African-American children are several times more likely to be suspended or expelled from school or to end up in the juvenile and criminal justice systems. Nationally, black boys are three times more likely to be suspended than white boys, and black girls are four times more likely to be suspended. And in Ohio, our statistics mirror the national statistics, and it varies from city to city here in Ohio, but in Toledo, for example, which has some of the worst racial disparity in the state, African-American kids are up to four times more likely to be suspended. And it's not much better in other cities. It's at least twice as likely for African-American kids in most of the big cities in Ohio. Other factors, children who grow up in low-income families, children who are poor, are twice as likely to be suspended statistically for the same behavior. And children who are disabled are twice as likely, and depending on the disability, more than twice as likely to be suspended. So if you have a child who's African-American and poor and disabled, you've got sort of the trifecta, and those are the kids who are most at risk in our system.
In reference to police presence in schools, I read one report that said students are the most police group in this country after inmates. So what are school resource officers? We hear about them in schools, and how are they part of this equation?
Well, school resource officers most of the time are police officers who are just assigned to work in schools. And the thing that I always emphasize in talking to people is that I'm not trying to demonize school resource officers. They're just doing their jobs. But the thing that we need to keep in mind is that they're police officers. They're not educators, and they're not disciplinarians. They're trained to identify criminal activity and apprehend suspects and arrest them. They're not trained to educate children. They're not trained to provide interventions when a child's having a breakdown or an anxiety attack or they're not trained to break up a fight and send the kids on their way or sit down with them and talk about it. They're trained to arrest them. And mm-hmm. and so when we bring them into our schools, you know, we have to understand what we're getting. So I think that some communities have really worked with the school resource officers in their schools to try to change their role a little bit and get them training and get the staff training and refocus what police officers in schools really can do. But I think that we as a country need to rethink what we're doing when we bring police officers into schools. Is that the kind of message we want to send to children? Because some schools really do feel like prisons when you walk into them. I mean, I've rarely been to a public institution that's supposed to be focused on nurturing and education, where if you're going to an inner city school and in a large urban area in any state in the country where there aren't metal detectors and security officers walking around, it does not feel like a school, or at least not the schools that I remember from when I was a kid.
Well, so you were talking about sort of the impact on the school environment and in the field. What other impacts have these policies had on youth communities and even the court systems?
I always tell people this isn't something that solely affects the children and the families who might end up in this pipeline. So, of course, it's devastating for kids to get a criminal record, to be part of the juvenile justice system at an early age. You know, that doesn't bode well for their futures. It's hard on their families, and so it's bad for them. But it's not solely an issue that impacts them. It impacts all of us, because having kids out of school, having kids in the criminal and juvenile justice systems coming in and out of that makes our communities less safe. I live in a urban neighborhood in Columbus, and I can tell you what kids are doing when they're not in school. They're, vandalizing garages in my neighborhood. And if kids aren't supervised, if they're on the streets, if they're not in school, I mean, I always ask people, what do you think kids do? Where do you think they go when they're suspended from school? If they have parents who work, and particularly kids who live in working class neighborhoods where their parents are often working more than one job to get by and don't have the resources to provide high quality supervision or programming for their kids when they're not in school, these kids are on the street and they're unsupervised and they get into trouble. You know, kids do that. So it makes our neighborhoods less safe. It puts the kids themselves at risk of becoming victims of crime. A lot of the trafficking problems that we've been talking about in Ohio, a lot of these are kids who have sort of been marginalized either from school or from their families or both. It's devastating. And actually, I've got some statistics here. Kids who don't finish high school, so these kids who have been suspended and expelled repeatedly, arrested in school, and who don't finish high school are 3.5 times more likely to be arrested as adults, even if they don't commit crimes as kids. And additionally, approximately 82% of the adult prison population is composed of high school dropouts. So that just sort of shows, that was a staggering statistic to me. So the consequences for kids not finishing school to all of us are very high. They're also much more likely than high school graduates to be and remain unemployed and to earn less money if they do gain employment. And they're also much more likely to receive public assistance, to be on welfare at some point during their lives, than if they'd finished high school. So the consequences are pretty dire.
And I don't know if you can speak to this or not, but I think people believe that if youth are then sent into the juvenile justice system, somehow their educational needs will be met, and that's not true at all. And in fact, they often have problems in even re-entering their own community and getting back in school. Can you speak a little bit to that?
Yeah, I mean, it varies from facility to facility, from state to state, what kinds of educational opportunities there are for kids if they're in detention in the juvenile facilities. My experience is that not very much of it is high quality. a very high percentage of kids in the juvenile justice system have special education needs, and my experience is that the correctional facilities don't do a good job of providing those services. And yes, we have huge problems with kids reentering school once they get out. Most kids who do get detained, I think, spend a very short period of time in detention, but then reentering school once they get out can be very difficult. And in my experience, many of them have been expelled from school in addition to having been sentenced to serve time in a correctional institute, so they might not even be able to return to school right away when they get out. And statistics show, too, that changes in a child's educational stability, so moving back and forth from school to school, moving from program to program, you know, one move can set a child back up to 6 months academically. So multiple moves over a short period of time set children back very, very far, and it's very hard to catch up from that, particularly if you weren't the model student before all of this happened, and or you had disabilities that you may or may not have been getting appropriate services to address while you were in school.
I think it might also be helpful if one or both of you can provide some examples of why students have been expelled, because I think we always think of the worst case scenario, but there's really, I think, some surprising examples. So I don't know if you have any of those ready of kids who've been expelled because of some zero tolerance policies.
This is Judge Brown, and I would say that probably the thing that people don't anticipate most is the fact that verbal threats, even with a history of not following up on the verbal threats, oftentimes will lead a student to being expelled.
Absolutely. I have a couple of pretty alarming stories that I can share. When I was practicing in Chicago, we had a client whose six-year-old had been expelled from school for 2 years. And the reason he was expelled from school for 2 years was that he needed to bring a box of crayons to school. It was one of the required supplies that his family needed to provide. And he was staying with his grandmother, and she didn't have any money to buy a box of crayons for her grandson. So she borrowed a box of crayons from another relative, and this child took the box of crayons to school. And when he opened it, inside was a bullet, just a single bullet, not a gun, just a bullet. And a student sitting next to him saw it and told the teacher, who reported him to the principal. And this is one of those zero tolerance policy mm-hmm. situations. He was viewed as having brought a weapon to school, and that mm-hmm. was a mandatory 2-year expulsion for this 6-year-old child. And in Illinois, like in a lot of states, including Ohio, there's no requirement that schools offer alternative education to children who are expelled. So the 6-year-old sat out of school for 2 years. So that's just sort of a really extreme example. And actually, the organization I was working for, we appealed that and actually ultimately won. But he'd been out of school for almost a year before we got the appeal heard. So these kinds of things.
So there's lots of circumstances like that where you wind up with otherwise small offenses, like the pocket knives the Swiss Army knives that parents give their children. If they exceed that 2-2.5-inch blade requirement, regardless of what they do with it in practice, whether they, you know, clean their toenails with it or they use it to tighten up the screws or the chain on their bike, those little somewhat benign violations of zero tolerance policies oftentimes will get students suspended for great lengths of time or expelled as well.
Right. And, you know, and I will say, too, that, you know, sometimes students do things that they shouldn't do. They get into fights. They bring alcohol to school, you know, and those are things that they should be punished for. But when we expel them from school for significant periods of time, I think that the punishment doesn't fit the crime. I mean, students certainly need to schools need to react. They shouldn't ignore those things. They need to address them. Misbehavior shouldn't go unaddressed. But expelling a child from school is a very, very serious sort of thing to do. And I always, you know, I want people to understand that there are some absurd situations that result from these policies. But the situations where they're supposed to apply aren't really appropriate either. And that's particularly in light of the fact that more and more research is showing that child brain development doesn't allow kids to make good decisions about these things. I mean, brain development research shows that kids don't develop the ability to make well thought out, reasoned decisions and to weigh the consequences of those decisions until you don't develop that ability in your brain until your early 20s. Mm-hmm. So we're asking 16-year-old kids to do something that they literally, in a lot of situations, can't do. They can't think this through. And you know, the Supreme Court has acknowledged this in its Roper versus Simmons case, where it ruled that the death penalty was unconstitutional for juvenile offenders, and then again in Graham versus Florida, where it ruled that life without the possibility of parole was unconstitutional for non-homicide offenses. In both of those cases, it cited extensively to that research as a justification for treating children differently than the way we treat adults for misbehavior. So even, I would say, even in situations where kids do legitimately do something that they should be punished for, removing them from school, having them arrested in school, may not be the appropriate response, because the consequences for them and for our communities is so devastating.
Right. So these policies really don't allow any type of individualized approach at all. What is being done around the country to address the pipeline? And then we'll turn to what's happening here in Ohio.
Sure. Well, one of the things that I'm particularly involved with around the country is, I'm, as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, Lauren, a core group member of the Dignity in Schools campaign, which is a national coalition of community organizers, parents, youth, and advocates to fight for fairness and dignity, for children to be treated with fairness and dignity in schools. And DSC is supporting advocates who work directly with community organizations, parent and youth organizers, to get school districts to change their codes of conduct, to eliminate zero tolerance policies, to implement positive behavior supports, school-wide positive behavior supports, which identify and address issues before they become huge disastrous fights or, you know, weapons confrontations or something like that. And so the sort of grassroots movement, really fueled by parents and youth who see what this is doing to their communities and want to change it, is a big thing that's starting to happen all over the country.
So Judge Brown, maybe you can give us a snapshot of what is happening in Franklin County, how you became interested in this issue, and how you're leading an effort.
Well, okay, thank you. Well, how I became interested in it. I, as a juvenile judge for the past 9 years, I've always been concerned about it, but we typically delegate the lead role on these sorts of issues to the lead juvenile judge here in Franklin County. And I took over that role in January of 2009 and immediately began being besieged by, you know, community advocates. You know, this is a huge problem where it's not being addressed. And so I also became the co-chair at that point of our Franklin County Juvenile Justice Community Planning Initiative. And that was before the county got involved with the Annie E. Casey Foundation. Our, what we call our JJCPI, is a countywide spinoff of the state Disproportionate Minority Contact Board. And it's compiled of representatives from every major system, the court, the Columbus Department of Public Safety, the Franklin County Commissioner's Office, the Police Department, Children's Services, Columbus City Schools, the Franklin County Prosecutor's Office, the Franklin County Public Defender's Office, Job and Family Services, all the major systems that impact the lives of children that are in juvenile justice sit on this board. And the board had been, the committee had been alive and gathering a lot of research for the first 3 years, but hadn't really gotten around to doing anything about it. And shortly after I took over the co-chair spot on behalf of the court, our other co-chair here is actually our city safety director, Mitchell Brown. And after I took over the co-chair, I met a gentleman by the name of Judge Stephen Teske, as I'm sure you ladies both know who he is. He's a juvenile judge from the state of Georgia who is, by many accounts, the leading expert in this school to prison pipeline theory and his efforts to reform it. And he introduced me to the Annie E. Casey Foundation. Our Franklin County JJCPI had asked Annie Casey to come in and take a look at the county for inclusion in its many, many programs back in 06 or 07, and for whatever reason, the foundation declined and said that, you know, Ohio wasn't ready.
And so the JJCPI, you know, put together some statistics about, you know, what it had gathered and what its concerns were. And we brought Judge Teske in here to actually talk to us in real terms about how it started in Georgia, what he did, who he needed at the table. And it was a well attended program. He remarked that he expected to be meeting with about six people representing these major systems, and instead he was greeted with a conference room of about 70 people. And it really impressed him that Franklin County was that interested in finally bringing some solution to the problem. Mm-hmm. After that, we kind of modeled ourselves after the Georgia model and started bringing the major players to the tables. And Sarah described very accurately the SROs and what they do in the schools and sometimes how they're perceived. And before we started our pilot program here to reduce the number of incidents that were considered zero tolerance, mostly in Franklin County, they're assault arrests. That's what we track mostly. That's because that's what mostly they are. Before we started our program, we were receiving from the schools on average of, you know, 86 to, I would say on average of 75 to 100 assaults from the schools every year. And Sarah is very accurate. 80% of those kids were African-American males, and it was the beginning of their juvenile justice encounter. We met over the last summer with all 17 of our school resource officers from the Columbus City School District and all of the administrators. We did a three-day conference where we talked about the issues and we really just rolled up our sleeves and brainstormed the issues. And I'm very pleased to report that in less than a year, we've been able to reduce that number by half, by less than half. Just working in collaboration, renegotiating the memorandum of understanding between the schools and the police about how these incidents were to be handled, and that's just the first phase of it.
Mm-hmm.
So we have been able, since June, to cut in half the amount of referrals that we're getting from our inner-city schools. And that's kind of what we've been using as our jumping-off point to then tackle our alternatives to detention program here at the court.
Well, you mentioned a protocol, and that might be the agreement that you're talking about. I don't know if you can sort of get some highlights of that. So for listeners, maybe in other jurisdictions.
Sure. What we have is a memorandum of understanding. And Sarah was absolutely right when she spoke about the historical use of school resource officers in the school. They were first and foremost police officers. And there was a reluctance to consider yourself in any other role than the same role that you would play if you were a police officer on patrol on a street, on a public street. And then that was one of the biggest parts of our conference, to talk about what some surrounding counties had done, what some other states had done, to kind of change that mentality a little bit and realize that we are dealing with children and that, you know, this is the same kind of behavior that, you know, 15 years ago was not treated as an assault. It was treated as an affray, a scuffle, and it was broken up and addressed. A lot of that also has to do with roles. Who's playing what role? Are you asking then a police officer to deal with school disciplinary problems, which should rightfully be the burden of the administrators? And so our protocol addresses these things. It addresses that we will never disrespect a police officer and ask you to be anything but a police officer. But it does talk about which equipment, you know, will be in the schools, which equipment will not be in the schools. It does talk about who is primarily responsible for school discipline, who is primarily responsible for maintaining safety. It talks about a first, second, and third offense approach and the different parameters for what's to be done at each level of those steps and what the options are. And that had never been discussed before.
Great. I don't know if either of you have any information about maybe things that are happening in other parts of Ohio on this. Sarah, do you have any knowledge?
Well, generally speaking, I can tell you that when we brought Annie Casey in
in Franklin County. They also met with our Department of Youth Services and decided that Ohio was ripe to become a statewide site, not just a county site. And they invited all of the major counties. Five of us accepted that challenge, and that's Cuyahoga, Franklin, Lucas, Montgomery, and Summit. And we are all in the process of doing a utilization study and determining our baseline information for the past 2 years so we have a baseline to judge our results. So we're all those five major counties are starting out with the Andy Casey Foundation just now. And so we're all in the same process. Hamilton County is not an active participant, but they're frequently represented at our statewide meetings. So I would say that the other major counties are participating. They're all addressing these same issues and trying to better serve our youth through exercising alternatives to just straight detention, because as Sarah put forth a number of impressive statistics earlier, they're all accurate. It's all very truthful. You are essentially cutting a child's chances to obtain a high school diploma by 50% having spent one day in our juvenile detention centers or our state institutions.
Judge Brown, maybe you can explain to our listeners why judges are in a key position to lead efforts to stem the pipeline, and then also share some suggestions to judges themselves who want to do something similar to what you're doing in Franklin County.
You know, that's an interesting question, because as I was being dragged along to Kansas City and to Florida by the Casey Foundation, I didn't understand it at first. To me, it was a school issue or a police issue or a parent issue, and I didn't really understand it until I started, trying to understand my role in the whole system. And I guess it's the easiest way to explain it is the buck stops with the judge. You know, the police can charge, the prosecutor can prosecute, the defender's office and our defense bar, they can defend, but in the end, the judge is the one who maintains control over these children's lives. We decide whether they're detained. We decide whether they're released. We decide whether they're permanently committed to the Department of Youth Services. We decide what resources are brought in to help these families cope. We decide the community options. Many times we decide the funding for those community options. So that was kind of an awakening for me. You know, I didn't really realize how much the judges played in this whole role, especially things that started in the home or started in the school. And as far as other judges that want to take the role and want to take a lead role in changing the system, I would, you know, Judge Teske will come out to any jurisdiction and talk about his experiences and share his wealth of knowledge. It's not a cookie-cutter approach. You can't say that Judge Teske's program will work in other jurisdictions. And I say that for two main reasons. Number one, Judge Teske is an appointed judge, whereas the rest of us are elected judges. And number two, Judge Teske is in a non-unionized state, and Ohio and the surrounding areas are largely unionized states. So whereas Judge Teske could just, you know, kind of say, I'm in charge and this is how it's going to be done, you know, the roles and responsibilities of police officers are oftentimes dictated by their collective bargaining agreements, the roles and responsibilities of teachers in the schools, and their safety parameters are oftentimes dictated by their collective bargaining agreements. So it's a great model to use, and I think that any jurisdiction can make this work and can create improvements in his or her jurisdiction if you take the time to meet with the other partners. The other thing that you have to do absolutely is build a coalition and a collaborative spirit amongst your major stakeholders. Key absolutely is your defense bar, your prosecutor, your school, and your police. You have to have those partners, and I would add Franklin County Children's Services as a must-have partner. Because as you identify these kids and we say, okay, well, you know, this child is having problems at home, this is not a bad, quote-unquote, child, then that automatically can create a situation where instead of sending them all to detention, we're sending all these kids to Children's Services. And you cannot burden your partner like that. You have to work together to find the proper fit of resources and services for the family without overworking and overburdening an already stressed out family situation. So those are some thoughts that are key. But the jumping off point, I would say, is to have either Annie Casey Foundation or Judge Teske come in and have a presentation so that you can see what other jurisdictions are doing. And even if you don't want to do that, they have a wonderful website that details all of the things that they're doing in different jurisdictions with, you know, plenty of reading material, research material, data, statistics, and any jurisdiction that's interested in making a change could start there.
Great. I just want to remind our listeners that if they want to call in and ask our guests a question live on air, that phone number is 347-994-1149, and then they need to hit the number 1 on your keypad, and you will be placed in the queue and screened by ANSA. Sir, I don't know if you have anything to add to what Judge Brown just said, but we just talked about a lot of sort of the system partners that need to be involved in this. Something that just came to my mind is what the community, what's community members, and Sarah, you've been involved in a lot of advocacy efforts around there. What can we do? Give some thoughts about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that people in the community can and should be involved with changing policies, and I think that it's really, really important for judges and, you know, prosecutors and defense bar and school administrators and the police department and children's services. It's crucial for all of those people to be talking to each other, and I think that the initiatives that Judge Teske and Judge Brown and other judges around the country have been putting into place have been amazingly effective at addressing this issue. But I also think that grassroots organizations and community members can play a huge role in pushing for changes in their schools and the way these kinds of issues are approached in their community. And they have. For example, in Denver, a parent and student organizing group called Padres y Jóvenes Unidos, Parents and Children United in Spanish, went to the Denver Public School Board and advocated for changes to their student code of conduct and got very serious restrictions on when suspension would be used, placed into the code of conduct, and worked with the school to put positive behavior supports in place so that students would be taught positive behavior. I have dogs, and so I always talk about positive behavior supports. It makes sense to me in that that's what I do with my dogs. I don't kick my dogs out of the house when they do something wrong, even though sometimes I want to. I reward them for the positive behavior and try to teach them that that's what they should do to achieve whatever it is they want to achieve, rather than engaging in negative behavior. And over time, that's effective. And it works actually pretty similarly with kids. Kids don't, you know, they're not born with manners and an understanding of how to function in an adult society and how to function at school and what's appropriate and what's not. They have to be taught that, and a lot of them have disabilities that hold them back. So positive behavior supports is just one way to sort of help teach kids how to behave appropriately. And you know, and I see a lot, too, a lot of people blame it on parents. Well, their parents aren't teaching them. You know, I have a lot of clients, having worked for legal aid for many years, a lot of my clients, the parents are disabled, the parents are working, the parents have taught the kids at home, and the kids are good at home, and they're not at school. They need to have that consistency across both home and school, and so schools need to be working on that. So I've seen some very effective participation from parents and students and community members, and so I wouldn't tell people that they can sort of sit back and relax just because they have a go-getter judge like Judge Brown in their community who's doing something to address this issue on her end. Community people need to be demanding this from schools as well.
You know, I couldn't agree more, and I thank you, Sarah, for mentioning that. We have come to the same conclusion, and we do have a number of our community advocates, including Barbara Turpin from Children's Defense Fund, on our CC or on our JJCPI. We have the South St. Vincent's and, you know, the various settlement houses there, too. But we also have just recently contracted with a consultant to get out into our faith-based community and hold some common sense, you know, parent-supported sort of what you need to know about keeping your own child out of the juvenile justice system. While parents are not always responsible, if you're a single parent and you are working two jobs to make ends meet, and that means that your child is left unattended a lot, some of the things that we're trying to teach at these community intervention meetings are, you know, having a backup plan, having a suitable sitter, you know, having some real live conversations with your child about your expectations and just basically interacting with the family. One of the things that we found when we first did our analysis, our baseline picture, if you will, we had to scour through all of our records and all of our filings and all of our dispositions to find out our snapshot in time picture, the jumping off point. One of the things that we found that was so alarming was one of the main reasons our children are in our local juvenile detention facility was because there were police calls to the home. In other words, parents were calling on their own children. Either the children were unruly or they were striking them or they were, you know, AWOLing, you know, running away from home. And those are the types of things that these community intervention meetings are designed to address. Other tools, other resources that parents have, short of filing an unruly complaint against their child, which, again, unfairly pushes the child right into the heart of the juvenile justice system, or short of calling a police officer out to the house to address, you know, commonplace issues that in a two-parent home or maybe passed off between the parents or maybe there's a designated parent that handles discipline. But a lot of these parents are just simply overwrought. They're overwrought, and some of them are unqualified to handle the trials and tribulations that come with a person age 10 to 17.
Right. You'll often hear parents saying that they were looking for just some help and they didn't really understand the consequences long-term of that call that they made.
Absolutely. And that's some of the things that we're trying to head off, because they don't. All they're doing is looking for help. And it's unfair to force our community payer, our community members and our taxpayers to introduce their kids to juvenile justice in order to receive help. It's unfair.
So that kind of leads us into some public policy recommendations. And this question is for both of you. Do you have some specific recommendations for Ohio and how to improve or, I guess, build upon what we're already starting here?
Well, I think that we can start, you know, there are some simple and some not so simple things we can do. Simple things that we can do are, right now we have a statewide zero tolerance statute that requires schools to use zero tolerance. Why don't we get rid of that? That wouldn't be very hard. You know, in schools, it seems to me like a politically popular message. I mean, really, zero tolerance is a pretty anti-democratic approach. It's basically the state saying to local school districts, you need to do this way, and you're not allowed to consider any individual circumstances at all. And that seems to be something that most people would find not appealing to me. I think it's very clearly time for that law to go. It's clearly not working. It's clearly not made our schools safer. And the other thing is that, you know, to the extent, you know, we have tight budgets, we have difficult situations in all of our school districts right now, but to the extent that we can focus on providing better support to teachers and to staff in schools so that they understand how to address these issues, I think that is the sort of investment that pays off big time. I can't tell you as an attorney how many times I've gone to an IEP meeting at a school, and that's an individualized education program meeting for students who have special education needs. And the teachers have really just said, please tell me how, you know, what I should do to fix this behavior problem that this child is having. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. And I think that's because, you know, a lot of them don't get a lot of training on that, particularly, you know, teachers who aren't special ed trained. They're not trained to deal with special education, but they're teaching special education kids. They need that support, and they want to do well, but they just need the training and the support. And that's that seems to me a pretty basic thing that we can be encouraging and providing. And to the extent that we can get school-wide positive behavior supports and restorative justice and restorative practices-focused programs to address misbehavior, I think that's very appropriate in a school setting. And I think that those changes would go a long way towards sort of preventing a lot of these problems that Judge Brown is seeing coming into her courtroom.
From my end, I think that my two biggest concerns are taking a look at the No Child Left Behind and where it places the school emphasis. When school dollars are being allocated based upon arbitrary benchmarks, I think that you almost incentivize a school's use of zero tolerance to rid itself of the troublemaker so they can focus on educating the performers, because the better your school performs, potentially the more money you can get. I just think that there's a huge incentive to get rid of kids who are an annoyance and criminalize behavior that really should be categorized as an annoyance. So I think that, that should certainly be looked at. And on the other end of the school-to-prison pipeline, I think that as a state, we need to seriously reconsider this notion of mandatory bindovers. In the state of Ohio, we have a law that says if you are convicted of a certain Category 1 or Category 2 offense, and those are your more serious felonies, and you happen to be 16 years of age, if a judge finds that there is probable cause that you committed the offense, you're automatically going to be tried as an adult. And I think that that law is somewhat skewing the statistics that we have, and it's reflecting that a lot of our children are probably worse off than they really are, because we have a huge population of 16 to 18 year olds who are committing offenses and are now in adult prison facilities. And again, you talk about what it does to their ultimate chances for rehabilitation, for a future, for a family to become contributing members of society once they're released, because the vast majority of them are not murderers. So at some point in time, society is going to again be confronted with these young people. And considering the fact that they went in at 16, even if they did 10 years, which is a pretty stiff sentence by all accounts, they'll be out and amongst us at a normal college age. And where we spend, $80,000 a year to house them in juvenile detention, or $45,000 to house them in adult education, we may very well, for those same number of years, put a couple of kids through college and actually bettered their lives. Mm-hmm. So I think that we really do need to take another look at that law and put some of that jurisdiction and that discretion back where it belongs with the juvenile court judges.
Terrific.
Yes. Those are great points, and I just want to pick up on Judge Brown's mention of No Child Left Behind, because I think I mentioned it at the beginning of the program as one of the factors that I think contributes to the school-to-prison pipeline. And there's a great report that was put out last year by the Advancement Project, a civil rights group in Washington, D.C., called Test, Punish, and Push Out, How Zero Tolerance and High-Stakes Testing Funnel Youth into the School-to-Prison Pipeline. And it's a very, very concrete and extensive sort of an examination of how No Child Left Behind and the high-stakes testing that has resulted from it have really upped the ante in terms of punishing children who don't do well on the tests and pushing them out of school. It gives schools a huge incentive to get rid of those troubled kids, because they're pulling down not just their sort of grade, but it affects their funding, it affects their ability to serve all their other students, and that is a huge problem. I think it's a completely unintended consequence of No Child Left Behind.
Absolutely.
But it is nonetheless clearly a consequence, and I know that there are some groups around the country that have been talking to members of Congress about trying to address that when the ESEA, the Education, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, is reauthorized in Congress this year, which people expect will finally happen this year. So hopefully we can address some of that too at the federal level.
Are there other resources either of you would like to mention to listeners at this point?
Well,
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Lauren.
No. Oh, that was Sarah.
I'm sorry.
There's some stuff that I sent to Lauren, posted on the Children's Law Center website. But there have been several national groups focused on this, including the Advancement Project, which I just mentioned. The Southern Poverty Law Center has put out some great reports, including a very recent report on racial disparities and suspensions for middle school students. And as most people in education know, middle school and ninth grade are the time when children are most likely to drop out of school. So suspending them in middle school can have even more deleterious effects than suspending them at other points in their careers.
Mm-hmm.
And the ACLU, both the national ACLU as well as several of the state chapters of the ACLU, are working on this issue. And I'll also just mention briefly that the Dignity in Schools campaign, the coalition I mentioned that I'm involved with, put out a national resolution for ending school pushout at the end of 2009, which was signed by over 200 organizations and individuals nationally, and which sets forth sort of a vision for how we can address this issue holistically, looking at all of the causes and basically just shifting toward treating children with dignity and as if they have a human right to an education. And that's at the Dignity in Schools website, which is dignityinschools.org. So I think that if you started with all of those places, you would probably have more information than you could possibly read.
Absolutely.
Judge Brown, did you have a few you wanted to mention?
You know, always the Children's Defense Fund is always a great place to kind of get up to speed. And they do a great once a year sort of expose, sort of critical look at all the courts and what they're doing, which, you know, I will be honest, for a number of years, I wait for it to come out so I can see how we're doing and where we need to adjust our work. So I thank them for their effort. And, of course, the Annie E. Casey Foundation, and their website is A as in Apple, E as in Education, C as in Cat, F as in Frank, .org. Real easy. And they have just links to everywhere and tons of publications for people who want to get up to speed on the issue perhaps before they really take it on. I think that, as you can tell, once you get into it, you become very passionate about the topic and about the problem and about the cause, and you really, really, really want to delve in even more. So any of these resources would be a great place to just become more knowledgeable about the problem so that you can, you know, dedicate your energies and your talents to being part of the solution.
Great. And let me just mention, Sarah talked about a bunch of resources that she forwarded, and they have been posted on the Children's Law Center's website, which is childrenslawky.org. And if you go to the news and publications section, there's Spotlight on Youth, and they're listed there. Also, you'll find information on JDAI that is happening in Ohio that Judge Brown mentioned. There was a fact sheet and brief for Ohio that was created in partnership with the Children's Defense Fund. And just to remind listeners that we had the team leader for Ohio speaking on JDAI probably about 6 weeks ago, so you can find that show in the archives. So we only have a few minutes left. We didn't know if we'd fill an hour, and we did. final thoughts?
Well, I would just, building on a couple of things that Judge Brown said, say that, you know, this is such an important issue, And it is something that affects everyone. It's not just a school issue. It's not just a court issue. It's a community issue. And I think that we've tried very hard to convey that, and I think we've done that pretty successfully. But I would also say, you know, this is something that we can fix if we can just get more people fired up and passionate about it. So I hope that people will go to those resources and learn about what's going on in schools and really contact school board members and policymakers in their communities and follow up with them on what they're doing to address this issue.
And I think that that's a great segue to my comment, which is even the best intended collaborative partners here cannot get this done, because so much of this is systemic and rooted in federal statute and state statute. We really do need to make our voices heard to our lawmakers. And that is something that we will be doing this year, making a priority this year for the Franklin County JJCPI as we're going forward, to make sure our lawmakers are aware that we have dire concerns with the way some of these laws are currently written. And we have a couple courageous lawmakers here that are a member of the General Assembly who are working with the courts to try to make some serious changes and put the discretion back where it belongs with the judges, who are aware and up to speed and working with the community on these issues. So hopefully we'll have more progress to report next year.
Well, I want to thank you both for taking the time to be on today's show. The information, it was excellent, really. Excellent, excellent, excellent. This show will be available on demand at blogtalkradio.com/spotlightonyouth. Our next show will be this Friday at 1:30 Eastern, and note that that's a different time than our usual 3 p.m. That show will focus on the state of New Jersey's implementation of JDAI, and guests will include team leader Lisa Macaluso, Judge Charles Rand, and Prosecutor David Sharp. In April, we're going to have a follow-up show to today's episode where guests will talk about specific strategies schools can undertake to deal with behavioral issues, as well as outline what legal advocates can do to protect the educational rights of youth, especially ones with educational disabilities. So to stay informed about these and other upcoming shows, you can either follow us here at Blog Talk Radio or visit the Children's Law Center's website. Take care and see you next time. Thank you again, Sarah and Judge Brown.
Thank you.
Thanks.